So we are continuing our discussion of Revelation chapter 7 today. We read the entire chapter last week. We're going to look at the second half. We looked at the first half, the 144,000. And as we just a little review of what's been happening so far. The scene, the stage that we should be picturing in our minds is a throne room in heaven, which is also the temple. The throne room and the temple are the same. God is on the throne. The Lamb is opening the scroll. We have the four living creatures, 24 elders, myriads of angels, and uncountable created beings all around this throne room scene. Once again, a reminder that the events that are being described through the seals are not the contents of the scrolls, but rather the scroll is the book of life containing the names of those who have been redeemed. Six of the seven seals have been thus opened. The four horsemen, a martyr church, and the judgment day of the Lord. And at the end of the sixth seal, the last statement is a question. And the question was, who can stand this judgment day of the Lord? And the presumed answer was, no one. And the audience would have assumed that the seventh seal would have been the one to be opened immediately following the sixth seal, but rather there was almost this kind of pause, an interlude, and a pause is thrown into this progression of judgment that was being described through the opening of the seals. And in this pause, there was John hears about this group that is identified as the 144,000, 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel. And we noted that this is reminiscent of an Israelite military census, as might be found in, say, the book of Numbers in the Old Testament. And this 144,000 then represents a complete count of those who are able to wage war. We noted that we should not be taking this 144,000 as a literal term, as a literal number. But rather, this 144,000 represents the completeness, something that is complete. And so in chapter 7, this represents the complete group of God's people throughout history. It's not something that's going to happen at the very end of time, but rather this 144,000 is representative of all throughout history who comprise God's people, who have waged war, are waging war, and will wage war in the context of proclaiming and spreading the gospel message. And we have noted that this 144,000 is the same as what we will now begin to read in the last half of this of chapter 7 of Revelation as the great multitude. And so
in verse 9, would you say that after this I behold and lo, a great multitude? Are you saying this great multitude?
Oh.
Well, you see, in the first part of chapter 7, John doesn't actually see the 144,000. He only hears about them.
Really?
Really. What he sees are the four angels who are holding back the winds, and then this fifth angel, this another angel that comes and says, no, don't let the wind...
I heard the number of them which were sealed.
But after this I looked and behold a great multitude.
So he hears 144,000 being described, and now he looks, and what he sees
is a great multitude.
Is a great multitude.
Of white robed.
Okay, not to just digress too far. Mine has a little a by a great multitude, and that little a goes to Romans 11:25. And the only thing I can see at the latter part of Romans 11:25, it says, the blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in.
That would be its interpretation based on dispensational theology.
Which is saying what?
Saying that
it's the fullness of the Gentiles.
There's going to be a fullness of the Israelites and the fullness of the Gentiles. Okay. So, coming back to the question that was asked at the end of the sixth seal, answer to who can stand is now being answered. No, it is God's people who can stand the day of the judgment day of the Lord. And so again, a brief review of the background. What John hears and what he sees are not always the same. We already saw that noted that in Revelation chapter 1, where he hears a loud voice like a trumpet, and then when he turns to see this trumpet, he sees one like a son of man. In Revelation chapter 5, he hears that this Lion of Judah is going to be able to open the scroll.
And what he sees is
when he turns to see this lion, what he sees instead is a lamb. Mm-hmm. And so it's the same pattern that is happening in chapter 7. He hears the 144,000, but he sees a great multitude. And we know that double versions of...
So what's your basic saying? He hears a lion and sees a lamb. He hears the 12 tribes, and he sees the great multitude of nations.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can do this, but you actually are portraying this as a drama, and you're doing good.
And last week we noted that this idea of the same object or one event being described in different ways has precedent in the Old Testament. For example, Joseph's dreams about the plague that's going to happen in Egypt, or that would be one of them. We noted that. White robes were appropriate for worship in the temple and were also used for the worship of gods in Asia Minor. Palm branches were especially used in the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, and this is the imagery perhaps behind what the great multitude, part of the description
and
of the great multitude.
White robes and palm branches.
Yeah. And there was Zechariah contains a prophecy that in the future the remnant of all nations would go up to Jerusalem to worship the Feast of Tabernacles. And perhaps so the imagery here is of that this great multitude is the fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy.
Well, one thing, so you're saying chapter 6:17, and who shall be able to stand, and it's saying the great multitude clothed with white robe and palms in their hands. Right? Is that what you're saying? That's the answer to the question?
Yeah, yeah.
The answer stands.
Then what was this issue with the churches? One church received white robes and one church was told to go buy them. Is that unrelated?
There's probably not much of a relation other than the
that's right in the letter.
The meaning behind the white robe. The white robe represents victory.
Right. So you could... No, I can't say you can get the white robe different ways, but the white robe... Okay.
It's from God.
Right.
We know that there are parallels between chapters 7 and chapters 4 and 5, and why that's important is that at the end of chapter 5, I believe, or towards the end of chapter 5, if I can get there. Verse 13 of chapter 5, John writes, "And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever." And so, in this parallelism that can be observed between chapters 4 and 5 and chapter 7. There's this every creature in heaven, and then there's this great multitude. And we can perhaps say that those two are the same.
It just felt like Revelation is, the whole purpose is to say, you know, you all are so familiar with these concepts, and now we're turning it upside down and saying, but this is that. It's like if the whole thing is... Yeah, we talked about the Jewish 12 tribes, and now it's this. We talked about the wine, but now it's the land. We talked about the...
Yeah, and one of the key points that John is presenting, is introducing, is that Israel is now the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's kind of hitting my head this whole week. I've been thinking about that. Mm-hmm.
So all of those prophecies and promises and descriptions of Israel that is found in the Old Testament, mm-hmm, now can apply to the church.
Question that we can't answer is, what is the church? That's where we all get snarled up.
Okay, so let's read verses 9 and onwards here. "After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.' And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, 'Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen.' Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, 'Who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?' I said to him, 'Sir, you know.' And he said to me, 'These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will shelter them with their presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes.'"
Is it a repetition of Christ?
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's just a refocus.
We read the entire chapter last week.
Got it. Yeah.
But we did not discuss
the
last half.
We didn't discuss the whole thing. Yeah. Okay. But I looked at this and I'm going, wait a minute. We read that last week, but no, it was different. That's what happened. But yeah, it is.
Because last week didn't make sense without the whole chapter.
Right.
So 9 through 17 is the answer to verse 17 of chapter 6.
The question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, you know, is this scene, this great multitude, does it represent a particular point in time, such as the end of time, or is it figurative? We've already discussed that the fifth seal, the slain souls under the altar, represent not literal martyrs, but the church throughout history, as in the martyr church. They don't represent individuals per se, but rather the church that is being oppressed throughout history. And we discussed that these souls are probably the same as the great multitude of chapter 7. In other words, all God's people are oppressed throughout history. The souls represent the church who are opposed by the systems of the world at each point in history.
Is that why people feel like if you're a Christian, you have to be tormented, or you're not a Christian?
Sometimes, I think so. Yes.
You know, because there is that thought. If you aren't having trouble, you're not a Christian.
That's a perversion, but anyway.
Uh-huh. But a prevailing one in a lot of circles.
What Revelation is showing is that, you know, there may not be physical persecution, physical oppression, but what it is followers of Jesus are at odds with the way the world works.
Right.
Their ethics are different.
And sometimes that may certainly lead to a literal persecution.
Or simply
I'll ask a loaded question. What you're presenting, is it predominantly coming from a single source or a multitude? Is there a common source? Where is this coming from?
Where is what coming from?
Your research.
Research?
From a lot of sources, right?
Multiple.
Is there a predominant a mainstream?
Well, there's the commentary that I'm, primarily basing it on is reading the New Testament series.
The New Testament series by?
And is it put together? Who's it put together by?
It's multiple authors. Each there's a primary contributor for each book. Mm-hmm.
Each New Testament book?
Each New Testament book.
Is it predominantly one denomination versus another?
No.
So a non-denominational commentary.
Is it truly non-denominational?
Everybody has biases.
Right, well that's what I'm trying to find out. Is it really open? And that's it's loaded because even if you said no, it's just it's Southern Baptist straight on. I don't care, but I'm just curious as to.
And I also use the English Standard Version Study Bible notes, which comes from a very distinctly evangelical perspective. I refer to the Adventist John Pauline.
Mm-hmm. Where he got that name and how he ended up in his profession is amazing.
John Pauline.
I guess the only thing that I would be concerned about is if the author or individuals had an agenda against Adventism, which I haven't heard from you, but I presume these people don't.
Why should they?
Okay. Because what appears to me is any logical thinking person is going to study this. And in the good old days, there were about eight or so, you know, there was a small group in New England that was studying. Mm-hmm. They're going to come up with a consensus and try to make sense out of this. Mm-hmm. And what they made sense out of this turned out to be what we've grown up in Adventism.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean that that's wrong or evil or bad.
No, but I think one of what happened in the latter half of the 19th century was their scholarship was pretty limited.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last few...
They had what they had available.
Yeah, last even 40, 50 years, scholarship on these...
has opened up.
Yeah.
So my concept of Seventh Adventist is open in that we're a like-minded people looking in a similar direction, and it doesn't bother me a bit to take long-held doctrines and I don't want to say redefine them, but take them apart and put them together a different way. It doesn't hurt me a bit.
But you don't like the idea of following someone who is specifically interested in...
If that's their agenda, yeah.
Correct. Who has agenda of... Whose assumed goal, whose goal is to
debunk.
Oppose mm-hmm. your right.
You
that
know,
makes sense.
But I think where I'm sad is Adventism of all people, based upon what they claim, should be open for this sort of dialogue. It should be open for this sort of reveal light. And
you light.
Yeah. If they are or aren't, that's too. And it all comes down to one very, very basic concept. We are not saved by knowledge. And what we consider as fact in science, 2 plus 2 equals 4. But in religion, we can understand this today and tomorrow can be totally a little different. And it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, if you recall in chapter, again, during the seals, was it the fifth seal, I think it was? The souls under the altar, they asked, how long? And I think that this chapter 7 answers that question as well.
And you're taking the 144... I can't say the words anymore.
The 144,000?
No, the 1,200 days?
Oh, okay.
You're throwing this out.
Well, I haven't gotten there yet.
No, but that's what we're heading towards, is this timeline that we have...
Oh, the 1,260 days.
Yeah, 1,260 days that we have built and then trying to put all the puzzles
and then,
together.
And then built our whole theology.
1844.
Yeah.
You're saying that, uh-huh. You know, those people may have connected those dots, and that's fine, and it's great, but, you know, in reality... it may not be necessary to connect those dots.
Right.
I mean, maybe it served a function.
Uh-huh. Right.
But what I'm hearing is there's validity in not connecting those dots.
So the souls ask how long, and the answer is, you know, God is going to bring, is going to allow judgment to fall when the time is right.
Uh-huh.
And so the kind of the corollary or application to that is that God's people shouldn't be worried about how long.
What I think that doctrine of the 1260 days, etc., has predisposed the people who have this mind bent of us and them, and there's going to come a time and they're going to get us, we're got to be separate, we've got to, and to me that is totally...
very up
and down. I mean, if you think about it, though, the whole idea of, you know, God's people experiencing oppression, the cataclysms in the world coming, it's happened throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
Every generation
has had its terrible atrocities.
And so this question of how long and who can stand is a universal question.
Mm-hmm.
It's not limited to
one group of people at the very end of time.
It's been happening, you know, all the way from the Israelites
in
the Old Testament.
No matter who you are, you only have a lifespan. It may be shortened, it may be lengthened, but, you know, every individual in the whole span of the earth, they only have their own life to equate it to, you know, and so you say, well, it was the Lisbon earthquake. Well, good grief, there have been a lot worse things happen than that.
It's been a long time since the Lisbon earthquake, and there's been a whole lot bigger earthquakes.
And you're just like, you know, every person has their life to deal with, where they are, when they are, you know, how they are. They can interact with God on a personal basis.
If someone back in the 1800s or thereabouts connected a particular prophecy with the Lisbon earthquake, that doesn't necessarily mean that
for the Millerites in the early to mid-1800s,
that means,
you know, the Lisbon earthquake, the dark day, the stars falling, those made sense.
It made sense, and what I like to think, we think that since God didn't come down and say, you're wrong, well then they must have been right.
It made sense to them, and God says, okay, go with this.
You go with it, but that doesn't mean everybody else has to go with it.
No, but he approved of...
He tolerated.
Well, I don't mean he approved of the particular views, but he approved of them doing...
In prophetic, interpretations of prophetic literature, there's what's known as multiple applications.
Uh-huh.
There can be multiple applications of prophetic passages.
Uh-huh. And God can be okay with that?
What I would say is, maybe they're God ordained, maybe they're not, but God tolerates because we have the freedom.
Uh-huh. And He makes good things come of it.
The bottom line, it doesn't matter if the Millerites believed in Lisbon earthquake or not, the bottom line was the Millerites Christ-like in their behavior.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. That's what God's looking at. He's looking at, did they wash their robes? And washing robes has nothing to do with the Lisbon earthquake.
So, coming back, the question was raised, so who is the church? Well, one thing we can say is that it can include every person.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
It's anybody who washes their robes.
See, because we in verse 9 we start out, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages.
And churches and denominations.
Yeah, that's everyone. So there's no restriction on who can belong. Not everyone will belong, as we've already seen. The sixth seal clearly shows that some will prefer the rocks falling on them to meeting the Lamb.
Right. Those are people who do not belong to the Lamb.
So what is the qualification for belonging? Well, we'll get to that in just a few verses here. But first, we go back to the Lamb. Again, John is reinforcing the concept that Jesus is equal with God, and therefore Jesus is God.
But I don't think we have a clue. When he calls him a Lamb, I don't think that we understand emotionally what that's telling those people.
Well, we're accustomed to the Lamb. That's old news.
You know, in chapter 6, the judgment is described as the wrath of the Lamb. Salvation also comes from the Lamb.
Would you be very concerned if I told you that there's a dragon going to come and do judgment on us tomorrow?
Yeah.
Would you be concerned if I said there's a judgment coming tomorrow and the Lamb's judgment is going to come? No.
Well, but we know, we might, because we know what the Lamb is. But if you imagine it being a literal sheep.
Well, I think it's saying that he's your friend. The judgment's coming and he's your daddy.
Got it. Yeah.
If you did something wrong, you better be afraid. But if you didn't, that's your dad.
So there is a different side of that, because wrath of the Lamb, Lamb would be thought of as completely innocuous, totally harmless.
And loud.
Yet, this is the source of the day of the Lord, the judgment, in the sixth seal. Which means, maybe is a way of saying, just because Jesus may appear harmless
doesn't mean he can't dole out.
Yeah, doesn't mean he has no power or authority.
That's true, but as kids, I kind of remember a couple times we had friends over and we got ourselves in trouble. Uh-huh. And Dad coming up the stairs. Our friends were afraid of our dad because he's big. We weren't afraid at all.
Because you were big.
Well, remember that this is being written, Revelation is being written to the churches who are supposed to be followers of Jesus, and Jesus has been ridiculed as one who is totally powerless.
Okay, so when he threw out the money changers, there's a lot of people that didn't run. Mm-hmm. And they weren't afraid.
No, but that's not where John is going with this, I don't think. I think he is trying to communicate to the churches that you can trust Jesus because he has power and authority to make right all the wrongs that are happening.
He has perfect wisdom
and authority.
Because I really do get the sense that these churches towards the end of the first century, 60, 70 years after Jesus, are questioning Jesus.
Oh, in other words, you're saying, are we following a leader that has no power?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I can see that.
Are we really following the right thing? Should we rethink this?
Yeah, that's another facet of this concept, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the scholars, whoever wrote these articles and whatnot, they are honestly seeking truth. They aren't trying to dispel any religion or anything that's not their
well, the best
guiding values.
Bible commentary writers are not the...
They're ones who are...
More scientific than religious.
They're trying to make sense
yeah.
of what's written and use the analogies and like devil sayings and devil, you know, using that to try to make sense out of something that just with one reading doesn't make a whole lot of sense in this day and age.
Yeah,
people
so
who look at the word, look at the literature and say, based on how it's written, what was going on at the time, what does this really mean?
Well, we've got 50 years of heritage built in.
I think, you know, we can see that there was, at this point in time, it was not unanimous. The view of Jesus was not unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
There were questions.
If he was all that great, why are we still sitting here?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And maybe that should be helpful for us as well. It's okay
to ask questions.
You know, our salvation is not dependent on
blind acceptance.
Uh-huh. And that is a problem of being, say, sitting in the pew of an Adventist church. To ask questions is heretical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're trying to thwart the foundation.
That's true of any denomination, if you really think about it. It just comes by the human nature of a group.
It gets more solid and solid and solid, and you can't break the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't
if you
true.
Broke the foundation, you lost the structure of...
The first couple of years of the Millerite movement, it was dynamic, but by definition, it gets locked down.
Right. As people begin following it, as an individual group of people find their new ideas, it's new and different, but as people follow the new ideas, they become followers and believe what was told to them rather than continuing to discover and think. And yeah.
It's human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this last part of chapter 7 is a resumption of chapter 5. Chapter 5 ended with a scene of worship, and this last part of chapter 7 resumes that scene of worship.
Mm-hmm.
5:14 ends with Amen and the elders falling down and worshiping. 7 verses 11 and 12 begins with the living creatures and elders falling down and with the word Amen. Then it continues to the blessing and glory and all of these phrases,
mm-hmm.
which echoes verse 13 of chapter 5. So it's the scene of worship that's continuing. An elder comes to speak to John. Now back in chapter 5, when John weeps that no one can open the scroll, it's an elder that comes to reveal that the Lion of Judah, which then appears as a lamb that was slain, is able to open it. In chapter 7, verse 13, an elder comes to ask John about the great multitude and how they got there, and explains that they got there through the blood of the Lamb. And I think the implication there is, you know, the elder comes to ask or to reveal something about this Lion of Judah and the scroll, and then he comes to ask, an elder comes to ask about the great multitude, and so you get the sense that the two must be related. In other words, this is further evidence that the scroll is indeed the Book of Life. It contains the names of those who are redeemed, those who are compose the great multitude. The scroll is about the redeemed. the elder describes this multitude as having come out of the great tribulation. Mm-hmm. So what is it? You know, it's translated the great tribulation, which in English, you know, the is a definite article, meaning some particular specific thing.
Rather than some great tribulation.
In Greek, the definite article can also, in addition to pointing out some specific thing, it can rather serve to emphasize the noun, rather than to particularize it.
I see. Okay.
It's not just tribulation, it's the tribulation.
Or it's like a bold great tribulation.
Not necessarily
a single great tribulation, but great tribulation.
Tribulation in all caps.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Kind of an emphasis rather than a particularization of it.
Okay, interesting.
So verse 14 can be read without the. These are the ones coming out of great tribulation, with a particular emphasis on it.
What is tribulation? To me, the tribulation that Jesus went through, it seems like Abraham went through, Jacob went through, Moses went through, everybody sometime has to decide who is God, who's their leader, who are they going to follow.
And who are they going to trust?
Yeah, it's the inner turmoil of every person as they grow mature. They have to make that decision.
There's another grammatical point to notice, that this coming out is in the present tense, which means that this event, this great tribulation, is already happening as John is writing.
And
as we go back to the fifth seal in the martyr church, they're certainly undergoing some kind of tribulation, even if the word tribulation may not necessarily be mentioned. I can't remember if it was or not. Back to chapter 6 here. Back to the fifth seal. Been slain. No, tribulation is certainly not mentioned, but that, well, it's certainly they're undergoing oppression. And we've already noted multiple times that this is true for every generation of the church.
Is there another word of tribulation? What's the different Greeks on that?
Oppression, maybe.
Well, we've always taken it as oppression, then we take it as persecution. Maybe tribulation is, maybe it's not necessarily persecution, maybe it's, maybe there's some
trials.
Yeah.
Less specific.
Jacob went through the what do they call the of Jacob? What do they call that?
Jacob's trouble.
Yeah, Jacob's trouble. When he crossed over, didn't cross over the river, and that.
When he wrestled with the angel.
Yeah, that wouldn't be called persecution.
No.
What would you call that?
Grasping onto God to beg him.
Trial.
So this word translated tribulation comes from Greek phlipsis.
Oh, now I know.
Which literally means pressure.
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 Okay.
Which has been translated.
U.S. culture is stress.
Which can also mean afflicted or affliction, anguish, burden, persecution, tribulation, or trouble.
Anguish.
So, with those meanings, the great tribulation can mean all sorts of things. It can mean external pressure that is being applied to you, or it can be your own anguish for what is happening in the world.
What Jesus went to the wilderness supposedly to reconcile the choices that he was going to make. Was he persecuted? No. What was he? I mean, he basically brought it on himself. Anguish. Jesus went in the wilderness.
He was led.
So.
Yeah, he was driven, I think, according to how Mark interprets it.
Driven can be mean a third party, or you drive yourself. I mean, you're a driven person, usually means you drive yourself.
The place, the earlier place in Revelation where tribulation is applied to the church is the letter to Smyrna. This is Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. And it writes, "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death." So, you know, in the Great Tribulation certainly is an echo of that, what is already happening in Smyrna. There's also an allusion to Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. Where Daniel writes, "At that time shall rise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble as such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose names shall be found written in the book."
The book.
That rings very true.
So what do Adventists think this scroll contains?
Traditionally?
No, I don't know. The book of,
And what you, the Great Tribulation, that's what you read. When you combine Revelation and Daniel, that's what you come up with. And the 144,000 are going to be the ones that live through the tribulation without death.
Yeah. I guess in my own personal history, I've never heard the scroll of chapter 6 being equated with the Book of Life. But here again, Daniel chapter 12 clearly associates tribulation and the Book of Life. And if that's the allusion John is bringing in, then certainly this scroll must be the Book of Life. Now, if you read Daniel, there seems to be indications of some kind of special tribulation, you might say, that's going to take place. And verse 2, Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, continues, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt." And so if you take Daniel chapter 12 verses 1 and 2 together, it would seem that perhaps it would be correct to say that maybe there will come a special time of tribulation immediately preceding the general resurrection that takes place. that doesn't mean that, you know, this great tribulation doesn't refer to other tribulations. And we also need to keep in mind that the principle of interpreting Revelation is that Old Testament allusions do not necessarily have to incorporate every detail when it's brought into Revelation. So the chronological order that's found in Daniel isn't necessarily what John has in mind. It may be, it may not be.
Well, in our great wisdom of archaeological research, we might be able to ascertain what Daniel thought he wrote and meant in his day. We also might be able to ascertain what John interpreted Daniel to say, etc., in his day, and they may not necessarily be the same.
True.
I guess I like your phrase is, you might be able to take it this way, or you could read it this way. There's no need to say absolute. This is what there's no reason for absoluteness here.
And finally, this whole idea of coming out of the could also mean that there are people who aren't going to experience tribulation. Well, coming out, because the church in the letter to Philadelphia specifically noted that you will not experience tribulation that's going to fall on the rest of the world. So
you can lay love on people and not get bashed for it.
So what we see here is, you know, this whole idea of coming out of great tribulation, the interpretation, it can be taken in any number of ways, all of which can be correct.
The whole point, you are not saved by tribulation.
No. New thought for some.
Yeah.
That's not the mode of salvation.
Some people, that's their whole thing they live for. There's going to be tribulation.
And the point
and
being...
we're going to be the best because we're going to
be hurt the worst.
We're going to stand up through it and be the best.
Well, you know, some people
I know
like
what.
Us.
Some people literally bring tribulation on themselves.
Well,
they glory in it.
We need to teach young people at a very young age.
You're young enough.
We're in a sinful world and it ain't fair.
And that's the way it is.
Yeah. And God doesn't necessarily matter. Some are going to go through tribulation, some aren't. Does that mean the ones that went through tribulation get a better salvation than the ones that didn't go through
tribulation? They get red bands on their robes.
It ain't
well,
fair.
They
it's
died.
Not built on, your salvation is not built on fairness. That's unfair.
But God is.
So those who work all day and those who work for a couple hours and those who only work for 5 minutes, they all got the same pay.
Mm-hmm. And in our human thinking, that's like, what?
Not fair.
So, this great multitude, one of the qualifications for belonging is they have come out of the Great Tribulation. And we've noted that it can mean many different things. Another qualification is that they have robes washed white in the blood of the Lamb. And white robes were given to victors, those who have won victory. Palm branches are a symbol of victory, so together the white robes and palm branches returns to the kind of the military motif of the 144,000, the idea of a army of God. They have won the victory. The idea of washing of clothing, washing of robes, is perhaps an allusion to preparation for meeting God at Sinai. It's found in Exodus chapters 19, 10, and 14, where they were told to prepare for their time of meeting with God by preparing. And one of their tasks was to wash and make themselves clean. the importance of the blood of Jesus or the blood of the Lamb, we've already seen in chapter 1, verses 5, in verse 5, and also chapter 5, verse 9. Basically, the blood of Jesus frees people from slavery. The blood of Jesus ransoms people for God. And no, the blood represents life. That's throughout Old Testament, blood is symbolic of life. The shedding of blood is the giving of life. Of course. I don't think you can turn blood white, no matter how much bleach you add to it.
Blue blood, red blood, white blood.
We've noticed that Revelation describes white robes as both being given
and
being purchased, and those who have them taking active part in washing them.
Right, that's what I was trying to get at. There's an
What's with that?
Christians are active participants in salvation.
Okay.
There's
washing in the white blood.
You can't. Christians by themselves cannot. They don't have robes to begin. They don't have white robes.
Uh-huh.
God has to give them to Christians.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, you can't just. They can't just take them and do nothing with them, I guess.
I think the Great Tribulation is probably a key to a lot of this confusion.
What is the Great Tribulation?
Continuing with the robe, Jesus is the primary actor in providing the robe. At the same time, Christians are called to participate in the life that this robe represents, this saved life.
See, I think that's the point. You're taking on a personality. You're taking on characteristics. You're taking on a perspective that Jesus might have.
And so, this act of washing in Jesus' blood may represent Christians' commitment to participate in the self-sacrificing service of love unto death that Jesus lived.
But what's that quote in Matthew that Jesus said, "Take my yoke upon you," because it is
delight.
And so here we have the Great Tribulation, it's horrible, but in reality, it's not.
And if, looking back to what we looked at last week in regards to the sealing, the illusion of sealing comes from a vision in Ezekiel that Ezekiel had. Who were the ones who were sealed? They were the ones who were anguished by the sins around them.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't being...
The ones who disapproved of
that. Yeah, it's not written that they were being persecuted, but rather they were in terrible agony and anguish over over all the wrongs that were being done.
So if you put anguish in substitution for tribulation here, I'm not saying that's right, but that does give it a little bit of a different twist.
Yeah.
Say that again.
Those in the vision of Ezekiel, it was the presence of God leaving the temple.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, saying to the nation of Judah that God was leaving the nation. And as part of that vision, there were destroyer angels sent to kill all in Judah, beginning with the temple. But as in the vision of Revelation where God came and said to the four angels, you know, just wait until my people are sealed. The same thing happened in Ezekiel.
Right.
Sends a messenger in front of the destroying angels to seal those who are anguished and in agony over all the wrongs that are being committed in the land. And those are the ones who will be sealed.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you were saying that if anguish could be one of the meanings for persecution, then...
For tribulation.
For tribulation, yeah. That anguish that the people experience because of the wrongs in the land could be part of the tribulation.
And if you take that concept back to chapter 6, verse 15, if the kings of the earth and the great men of the earth, the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and everyone of those, rather than hiding themselves and asking the rocks to fall on them, if they had anguish... For God's people, or for the sins of the world, they would have had a different
twist. Then they
would
have welcomed what is coming. But the people who delighted in the whatever bad things are happening, when good wins, they want the rocks to fall on them.
Yeah. I could see from a different perspective this could have some.
Yeah, so again, it comes to the idea that great tribulation can possibly mean multiple things.
Well, I'm kind of liking the idea of anguish, because to be honest with you, tribulation comes to many people totally unfairly.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But anguish pretty much has to go to everybody, because everybody has to make... If they are a human being with a mind that's, you know, not deformed...
Everyone has to respond to
right.
The injustices of the world in some way.
Yep. Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
And finally, the robe represents belonging. You're given a robe... And you belong. The prodigal son in that parable, he's given a robe to signify that, you know, you are part of my family.
But the prodigal
and
is having anguish over the actions of his son. The prodigal was.
It's not the prodigal son. It's the prodigal son. Did you always think the dad was the prodigal?
Well, I think what he's saying is that we've, in the last few years...
No! You're saying the prodigal... What's the definition of the word prodigal?
Extravagant, wasn't it, that we discovered?
So you're saying extravagant son?
No.
No! That's
but, but the title of the parable is the prodigal son.
Are you saying the extravagant son?
That's the title of the parable,
no.
As it's always been.
Prodigal means the father of the house.
No.
And it's the son of the father of the house.
You would be in a very small minority.
The son went away and squandered the father's wealth.
Yeah. He squandered the prodigal's wealth.
No.
Prodigal's not a noun.
Prodigal.
No.
It's
an adjective. It's an adjective.
Oh, no! I thought it was a noun.
No.
You thought the dad was the prodigal?
Of course. The prodigal son.
No, it's the prodigal adjective describing son, the noun.
Do I have to admit that she's right?
Yes.
She's right.
But
I thought apostrophe F.
His father's wealth.
I know that.
But before, it was time to get it.
Well, I know that. I thought the prodigal was the father.
He's like, give it to me now.
Apostrophe S was his son.
But in the last few years, we have seen it represented where prodigal means extravagant, and the father is also prodigal.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's extravagant with his love.
Portrays God as being prodigal. And that was the new thing.
Yeah. Again, that is due to scholarship within the last,
The prodigal imagination, not down.
Recent scholarship says the son is not the only one.
It's sometimes used as a noun, as the prodigal, but it refers to the son.
prodigal used as a noun, the prodigal, refers to the story of the prodigal son, where it's used as an adjective. And the
extravagant son.
Yeah.
Using it as a noun.
He wasted his money until he had nothing. He didn't even have enough food to eat, and he decides that he could be a servant in his father's house.
Let's say the father was a baron. So we would say the baron's son. I thought
that's what you're thinking.
But there's no apostrophe S in.
I always said barons. I always did say barons. Prodigal's son. The baron's son. I had
Mary had a new spelling girl in last day for 16 years.
Pardon?
I once read something about someone who misspelled their own last name for 16 years.
Probably me. Oh. Tribulation.
You edit.
The thing is, the people in Vietnam, the natives there, the Vietnamese, they are ignorant. They never went to school. They happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And if anybody was ever in tribulation, they were in the middle of hell.
Uh-huh.
Had nothing to do with it. Now, anguish is a whole other ballgame.
Uh-huh.
And that is Jacob on the other side of the river. That's
and that is the sealed in Ezekiel.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that in chapter 6, the great men, the kings, etc., 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 they didn't have anguish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
At least the correct anguish.
They were not anguished by the injustices. They delighted in them. And so they ended up wanting the rocks to fall on them.
And their anguish was turned inwards rather than outward.
Uh-huh. That makes sense. Okay.
It may not be right, but it works for me.
The last part of chapter 7 of Revelation is, the last few verses here, is essentially another hymn of praise, song of praise, describing the results of salvation. And we'll just note in passing that some of these things we will find again in chapters 21 and 22, right at the very end.
Uh-huh.
First, the redeemed will be in the presence of God. They will serve as priests in God's temple. God will shelter his people. And this is an allusion to Isaiah chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, where Isaiah describes a new exodus of God's people. Now, just as God sheltered the Israelites with a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, God will shelter his people in this new exodus with the new Israel. He will provide protection from hunger, thirst, and elements. This is an allusion to Isaiah 49, verse 10, and Psalm 121, verse 6, where the Old Testament has prophecies of a future salvation, and these things are described. The Lamb is also the shepherd who guides and protects his people. The shepherd Psalm 23, Isaiah 49, verse 10, once more. And all cause for sorrow, loss, pain, and so on will be removed. And allusion to that can be found in Isaiah 25, verse 8, where it describes a future banquet for God's people.
Kind of in Psalms 23, 2.
Yeah, I read pulls on that one. You know, I like what you said last week in that the kings, the wealthy, and the big men, what did they do? They wanted the rocks to fall. Mm-hmm. And they got tribulation. When these people got tribulation, they worshiped God.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, you've never seen that before, but I think that's critical.
Whatever form the tribulation takes, whether it's active persecution or anguish over the injustices in the world or something between or different.
Yeah.
So I think what John is portraying here once more is that, you know, all those prophecies that you have been reading about in the Old Testament, you know, the future salvation, it's here. And it's going to, it's being fulfilled in Jesus.
See, that's kind of what I'm seeing is, it's taking, you know, you guys, you Jewish people, you read this, you know this, and you've got it in your whole life for generations. Now here it is. And we're doing the same thing today. Dolores and I have grown up in Adventism, and we're doing the same twist. The facts are still there, the words are still there, but the application is just taking a little bit of a twist. It's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So now, for kind of to wrap up chapter 7 here, the great multitude and the 144,000 are the same group.
Well, you said, and it makes sense, I heard the description of 144,000. I saw a great multitude.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of a drama, that kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you hear the narrator say something, and then you...
This is what I expected, yeah. But this is what I saw. Yeah.
No one can number it from every tribe, language, tongue, and people.
You know, I grew up hearing this. I knew this was going to be. This is what I expected. This is what I hear, which is in my mind. But what I saw...
You know, you hear a description of a complete census, and then you see a great multitude.
That you can't number. 144,000 you actually could number. I mean...
Well, in their vernacular, that may not be true.
Well, that's true.
But you know what? You think about... the armies of numbered armies in the Bible, they're way huge.
Right, but 104,000 may mean something to a Jewish person.
That means it's complete.
It's complete.
It has nothing to do with numbers.
A completeness. Everything's done.
Yeah, I've read commentaries on some of the Old Testament books by a Jew, and his note on a lot of the numbers found in the Old Testament is they're symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
They're not to be understood literally.
Yeah.
And what we want to do is
make the puzzle fit.
Well, yeah.
So it's talking. Chapter 7 is talking about God's people in its entirety throughout history, and what we see there is that God's people are continuously experiencing and being delivered from tribulation, whatever that may be. We talked about different ways of understanding that. John once again reinforces the idea that Jesus is indeed God. He has the full power and authority of God. We've noticed the irony that Christians receive salvation from God, the Lamb, and as they're on the other hand, those who...
Oh, I got a question. You just said something. You said Christians receive salvation from the Lamb. The multitude receives salvation from the Lamb. So you're saying the multitude are Christians.
Yeah, they are. They're all in white robes.
They follow the Lamb. They will follow the Lamb.
This multitude isn't... See, I used to think this huge multitude was everybody in the whole wide world that ever lived. But this multitude is the saved.
Right.
But in John's day of revelation, would have... Yeah, they would have been known as Christians, wouldn't they?
Yeah, by that, by then they would have been, yeah.
That label had been applied. They were definitely known as followers of Christ.
So Christians receive salvation from God, and as their acceptance, their part of their accepting the robe is to commit themselves to a life of self-sacrificing service.
Except I don't like the word sacrifice, but yes.
Yes, hang-ups as well.
Yes, I do.
Oh, really? We haven't noticed.
He doesn't believe you can sacrifice, that it's a privilege, that nothing...
No, that's not where God... It God's sacrificial giving doesn't make a bit of sense to me.
Because you believe it, that implies hurt. And
well, you're supposed to give till it hurts.
Give till it hurts. Yeah, sacrificial giving. Yeah.
So in our day and age, that doesn't apply.
I have $2 in my pocket. I can sacrifice. I can give the money to you now. And if I do, I'm going to sacrifice buying a milkshake this afternoon. So that's sacrificial giving, because I have forgone a good milkshake to give you the money.
You can't get a milkshake for $2.
He hasn't gotten one in a long time.
The only reason I gave you $2 is because I thought that had higher value than the milkshake. If it had higher value than the milkshake, then it's not sacrificial. It was a blessing. It was an opportunity. That's like saying, I'm going to sacrifice a milkshake for a glass of gold. That's not a sacrifice. That's a choice of something better. I believe sacrificial giving is to give something better, and therefore it's not sacrifice.
What else here? Chapter 7. Those who are saved, they belong to God, they belong to Jesus, and serve Him continuously. Those who belong to God are safe, although with the caveat that not all fulfillments are necessarily applicable literally in every way to this life.
Jacob was safe, but he still had a bum leg for the rest of his life. Yeah.
No, so this is in reference to this protection from hunger, thirst, elements, all cause for sorrow, loss, pain will be removed. You know, that's,
well, I think a lot of Christians had been persecuted with, you know, starvation, with having to stay in the sun, being burned to the stake. You know, I think that's maybe a alliteration. That all that is over.
And we need to keep in mind that this saved life is, there's those things that have already been completed, and then there are those things that have not yet.
Taking Revelation, forgetting about today and how it's talking about the future, in its day, John was telling these people, have confidence in the Lamb, you can trust Him, He's a good guy. And so I could see that this is a letter of encouragement to the people who are in the way to trust the Lamb.
Yeah. So the question, who can stand the judgment day of the Lord, is emphatically answered by this chapter. God's servants, God's people.
Which was them.
Yeah.
Which was the people who were listening to this narrative.
And finally, so with that, the audience with anticipation. Now, the seventh seal. What happens with the seventh seal? And that will reveal yet another surprise.
All right.
So, what we have is we have a book, and in the book, nobody knows, but everybody knows it's a book of life, but nobody knows who's in the book. So
they're all standing there in white.
They're saying, okay, we want to know who's in the book. So they have to open up these four or seven locks, which is the seven seals. And as they unlock the locks, then they can't open the book to see whose name is in it until all the seven locks are unlocked. Mm-hmm. That's
seals, those are the seven locks. That has no relationship whatsoever to being sealed in the forehead and sealed.
No relation.
And they shouldn't use the same one.
It's the waxes on the scroll.
Mm-hmm. But being sealed and a seal are two different concepts of mm-hmm. unrelated.
And all the seals are on the same scroll, right?
Yeah.
The seventh
yeah.
one is just the last one. They've been chipping away at them.
Yep.
And then there was that
popping open the
after
scroll.
The sixth snap comes off.
Well,
then
we thought we answered the question because we said, well, who can stand? Well, we told who can stand, but that is not who's in the scroll, because the seventh seal hasn't been opened yet. So right. we have an answer, but that's only an answer to it. That was an answer. Hold it, you.
Who can stand?
That is
God's servant. The opening of the seventh seal awaits God's
right.
reveal. And
who can stand? We've answered who can stand.
That was the question at the end of the sixth seal.
But we have not answered is what is in the book.
Correct.
Okay. So if we think the book is the seal of life, is the book of life, and we think it's all these people's names, we don't know that yet.
Right. We may now begin to suspect it. That's the case, but we do not know for sure.
Because what he said is, who's able to stand? He's not saying who's in the book.
Correct.
You are jumping to conclusions.
You are.
That guy's dead.